Welcome to a Prevent Connect podcast, where we explore the prevention of violence against women. This is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault.
This is David Lee of Prevent Connect, and I am speaking with Amanda Hess, who is the author of the sexist column and blog for the Washington City Paper. Good morning, Amanda.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, David.
I find the sexist blog to be one of the, sort of a funny phrase to actually be saying with the type of work we do, but the sexist blog to be really helpful and one of the blogs I really enjoy reading, because a lot of the content that you talk about are the questions around addressing rape culture and how to be able to undermine rape myths and be able to really unveil what's going on in the information I think is really relevant for all of us who are involved in the prevention of sexual violence and dating violence.
I mean, I think that's one of the things that's been surprising to me is how fun it can be. I'm sort of interested in presenting things in an entertaining way. I think the idea of delving into these issues and getting really specific about them and arguing about them can be not only instructive but also really fun for me. So that's been one of the surprising things about writing the blog.
So you actually have a whole series that's called Date Rape Anthem. Can you talk about what you're trying to do with that?
Well, I started that last year after Jamie Foxx's Blame It on the Alcohol song came out, and that was an extremely popular song, and I loved it. I love Top 40, and so, you know, I listened to the song probably about 12 times before I started to hear the subtext, which was about getting this woman extremely drunk and getting her back in your car. And, you know, in one of the verses, she's not really responsive. And the song is all about how the next day she can blame the sex that she had on the alcohol. And I thought, this is interesting. And so I wrote a little post about how the song talks about how people use alcohol to coerce other people into having sex with them, and then later blaming it on the woman for being drunk. And after I did that, I realized that so many other songs have really similar messages in them, going back to, you know, Baby It's Cold Outside, to, you know, tons of other songs. And so now I do those about once a week, just to sort of point out how a lot of songs that we hear on the radio and that we love and just, you know, sort of slip past us, but that when we really look at them, have sort of strange and disturbing messages.
Well, and you also have been highlighting songs that have messages that are against rape.
That's been one of the more recent ones I've done, and I'm getting a lot of songs sort of requested by people who say, I love this song, I heard it when I was in eighth grade, and it's anti-rape, and it's great. And these songs are generally not the more, you know, Jamie Foxx isn't doing these songs. They're not really on MTV, I guess you could say, but there are a lot of those as well. One of the things I talk about is how difficult it is to write a song like that, that's an activist song that's also a really good song. A lot of these date rape songs are really popular and they're really catchy, and doing sort of the opposite thing, going against the grain and writing about how terrible rape is, it's really tricky to have someone who can do that convincingly and also be a great artist. And so it's been great to discover these songs that manage to do both of those things.
You go everywhere from looking at Ayn Rand novels to examining the expose of groping in Washington, D.C. You talk about the groping series. I think that was a really interesting series that you really, I think, captured many different angles.
This was sort of a pet project for me this year. This series was inspired by a friend of mine who told me a story about being in a club the weekend before and getting groped and having a bunch of other people groped by the same group of guys. And I thought, this is terrible. I would love to write a story about this. And when I started sort of reporting the story, I ended up talking to a bunch of other people who had had really similar experiences and people who had been groped in the subway and on the street. And I decided that there were enough really interesting and complex dynamics here that it's something that I could go really long on. And I ended up writing a 5-column series about it and doing a bunch of other blog posts. And the series was directed at how women experience these sorts of things and how they respond to them. The first one was women who don't do anything and who sort of freeze in fear when this happens. I later ended up speaking with some men, too, who had had this experience when they'd been groped on the subway. And then the series went on to talk to women who responded verbally, who, you know, said, hey, stop doing that, or, you know, who notified later, went home and told a friend and said, this happened to me. Some women never told anyone. And then the third one was women who ended up physically responding. So they, you know, they responded by pushing the man away or hitting him or stepping on his toe with their high heel. And the last one was women who reported their assault to the police. And a lot of women don't have success with that. One of the biggest complaints that I hear about people who are who have doubts about sexual assault and how prevalent it is they say, well, if someone is sexually assaulted in public, say on the metro, someone grabs their genitals, why wouldn't they report it? And one of the things that I found is that a lot of women who do report it don't get any satisfaction out of it. Either the police sort of brush it away, or they don't follow up on it, or they end up having to, you know, really aggressively pursue the case themselves in order to get someone to pay attention to them. And so my last story was about a woman who did that exact thing, and the man who groped her in Subway, actually, they ended up catching him. They set up a sting operation to catch this guy, and so that was sort of the happy story at the end, but I did speak with dozens and dozens of women who had been groped, and a handful of men, too, who had never even received any recognition that this sort of sexual assault is happening to a lot of people all the time, and that it can really affect people for years. And so the vast majority of people that I spoke to, they didn't get any sort of support. The one woman at the end did. And so I think I was really, you know, by the time I got to the end of the series, I hoped that people would sort of understand how big of a problem this is and how underreported it is, how it's not taken very seriously. Some of my readers also got very annoyed with me as I was continuing to talk about it. I get that a lot, actually. People become annoyed that I keep pointing certain things out. I keep saying when rape songs come on the radio and stuff like that. And so I think that's a good sign.
Well, and I do too. And I think that that's part of the important part of thinking about what the internet and with social media and blogs and Twitter and all of those other pieces, how we can really work on shaping a conversation around these issues. And I think that the blogs like yours are helping give a really important view out there and help shape how we perceive these issues. And, you know, you've been talking about deconstructing rape myths, and you've been talking about, you know, how people, you know, use rape analogies, which drives me insane when I see people misusing the word rape all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's an important voice that we really need to be doing. How do you see your blog playing a role in trying to create shifts within our culture?
Well, one sort of interesting thing about this blog, I think, is that it is tied to a newspaper. And so I'm both doing this sort of community-based blogging stuff, and then I'm also reporting for the newspaper every week. And so a lot of stuff, and we're an alternative newspaper, and so a lot of stuff I'm approaching as, you know, ways to cover these issues in ways that basically the Washington Post is not doing. And so part of it is really focus on dismantling the way that people generally talk about this stuff and questioning that. The blog is actually an extremely fruitful resource for me. I get a lot of my ideas and a lot of the rape analogies and the rape myths that I end up thinking about and talking about, I get from people who read the blog. So what usually happens is I'll write a post that's about sexual assault, and someone will inevitably come in, and we have very low moderation of our comments on the City Paper website, so you can basically say whatever you want, and people will come in and with, you know, their argument about why either victims should be held responsible for their assaults, or why rape is not an issue that we should spend time talking about, or why we should educate women to, you know, stop dressing in a certain way in order to protect them. And that, you know, when someone leaves this comment, I feel like they're doing it to, you know, to speak up and teach me a lesson about why I'm wrong. But what they really do for me is give a really concrete example of how these rape myths are perpetuated in society. And that's something that I feel is really difficult to actually get a handle on. I think a lot of people, you know, have some sort of awareness that the conversation about rape in our culture is messed up, but it's sort of it's really difficult to pinpoint exactly how it's messed up. And so when someone leaves a comment and says, you know, getting raped is like walking in a bad neighborhood, if I don't want to get mugged, then I won't walk in a bad neighborhood by myself at night. And so, you know, that's a really clear example of something that I can take and say, well, you know, for women, we can't decide not to walk in a bad neighborhood or not to walk alone or not to walk at night, because the thing that targets us for rape is being women. And that's not something that we can make a conscious decision to stop doing. It's sort of a continually refreshed fountain of rape apologies sometimes in my comments. And that ends up being something that helps me to form my arguments and stuff like that.
So the internet provides you a lot of source material.
Yeah, it does. So that's great.
So why do you call your blog The Sexist?
I didn't come up with that name. An editor of mine did. About a year and a half ago, I think, is when the blog started up, and we had to come up with some name for it. And it was sort of a paper-wide event for people to suggest names that we could possibly call this blog in this column. And there were some of them were really bad. They were like sex puns, like bloggy style, I think, was one of them. One of my editors ended up suggesting The Sexist. I liked it when he came up with it, because that's what I'm talking about, is sexism, and it's also a blog that's about sex. So it's sort of like in Washington, D.C., we have DCist, so I'm sexist.
Ah, I did not know the DCist. Oh, so that's where. We've been talking with Amanda Hess, who writes the Sexist blog over for the Washington City Paper, and you can be able to find this at www.washingtoncitypaper.com/blogs/sexist. We will also have a link on the Prevent Connect website. So thank you. I really appreciate getting a chance to talk to you, and I enjoy reading your blog and look forward to your contributions to helping transform a culture so we're not going to be seeing sexism and to reduce and prevent sexual violence.
Thank you for listening to this Prevent Connect podcast. Prevent Connect is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. To learn more about Prevent Connect, visit www.preventconnect.org. For more information about CalCASA's mission or to show your support, visit calcasa.org. That's CalCASA.org.